Hello and welcome to this week's episode of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for People on the Go. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, joined this and every week by my friend and colleague, Dr. Amy Robertson. This week, the Narrative Lectionary finds us in Jeremiah 33, where the prophet Jeremiah, writing from the midst of the Babylonian siege of Jerusalem, dares to declare a vision of a hopeful and peaceful future. We discuss the audacity of holding out hope in the midst of despair, the relative significance of the Davidic king in Jeremiah's vision, and what, if anything, this text has to do with the Christian season of Advent in which this text is being read. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Bobby. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you this week?
I am doing well. I have been pondering Jeremiah.
I'm glad you have, because there is a lot to ponder with this text.
Can we get something out of the way first?
Sure, yeah.
Jeremiah was a bullfrog. There, we just have to, like, for the record, I'm done. That's all I have to say about that.
Okay, yeah. I mean, yes, he was a bullfrog, but he was also a friend of mine.
Okay, we had to. Sorry, guys. We had to do that. Okay.
I had trouble comprehending the words that he spoke, but the alcoholic beverages that he produced were quite delicious.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so this week finds us in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 33. We have moved in the narrative lectionary. So last time we were back in 2 Kings talking about the reforms of Josiah leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem in 586, mm-hmm. 587. So Jeremiah is now historically is right in that period. The beginning of his prophecy is said to be in the 13th year of the reign of Josiah, which places it a few years before the reform that we read about last time. Mm-hmm. And then he extends all the way down into the reign of Zedekiah and the beginning of the exile in 586. Mm-hmm. So if people are thinking about how to get into the book of Jeremiah in a way that helps us understand what's happening in this passage, what do you think we need to know?
I think what I would pull out is just what a hard, hard, hard time it was that Jeremiah was living in. Outside of sort of the, you know, period of modern tragedies that have happened with the Jewish people or other sort of peoples around the world, this period where we're leading into the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem is, I think, for biblical times, is comparable to that sort of level of pain and distress.
The commission that Jeremiah receives from God in chapter 1, verse 10, is to pluck up and pull down, destroy and overthrow, build and plant. So if you listen to those six verbs, pluck up, pull down, destroy, overthrow, four of them are sort of negative, destructive words. Mm-hmm. And then the last two, to build, to plant, are hopeful, constructive words. And in some ways, that really is kind of what Jeremiah ends up doing. He's sort of four parts destruction, two parts comfort, mm-hmm. or something,
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I like that a lot.
He was a very unpopular prophet with mm-hmm. the kings under whom he served. And he ended up being thrown into a pit for a while, and he was held in jail for a while by two different kings, Jehoiakim and Zedekiah. Mm-hmm. He was constantly getting himself in trouble. And the reason was, it seems to me, because he would say, hey, everybody, the Babylonians are coming for us, and God is going to let them conquer us because we have not done justice and righteousness. So we might as well just submit now, mm-hmm. And get it over with. If we resist, then it's going to be even worse. Mm-hmm. So this text that we're reading today, the narrative lectionary is Jeremiah chapter 33, verses 14 through 18, which is a little section of a bigger passage, which is itself part of an even bigger collection in chapters 30 through 33 that's known as the Book of Comfort. So what we thought we might do is try to read 33:1-18.
Give a little more context, yeah.
Now the setting of this text in chapter 33, in verse 1, it says, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah a second time while he was still confined in the court of the guard. And that's referring back to a chapter earlier in chapter 32, verse 1, where we get the statement, the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord in the 10th year of King Zedekiah of Judah, which was the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar. At that time, the army of the king of Babylon was besieging Jerusalem, and the prophet Jeremiah was confined in the court of the guard that was in the palace of the king of Judah, where King Zedekiah of Judah had confined him. So what's going on is in 32:1, it has given us that this prophecy is taking place in the 10th year of King Zedekiah of Judah. If you look back in 2 Kings 25, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians began a siege of Jerusalem in the 9th year of Zedekiah. So the siege, the besiegement of Jerusalem has been going on for a year at this point. Mm-hmm. The army of the Babylonians is all around the city of Jerusalem. They're trying to starve the people out of the city. 2 Kings 25 also tells us that the Babylonians breached the wall of Jerusalem in the 11th year of Zedekiah. So we're about a year into the siege and about a year from the destruction of the city. Right in the middle of that is when this prophecy of Jeremiah happens. And Jeremiah, who has been prophesying that people should submit to Babylon, is in jail, probably because he's been prophesying people should submit to Babylon, right? And so this is the setting, if you think of Jeremiah in that setting and writing these words that we hear. Anything else you want to say about the literary context there?
No, I mean, I think it's just you have to understand going into this that he is in like the deepest depths of darkness and fear as he's having this vision that, you know, that we'll read about.
Okay, so beginning then in chapter 33, verse 1. The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah a second time while he was still confined in the court of the guard. Thus says the Lord who made the earth, the Lord who formed it to establish it. The Lord is his name. Call to me and I will answer to you and will tell you great and hidden things that you have not known. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, concerning the houses of this city and the houses of the kings of Judah that were torn down to make a defense against the siege ramps and before the sword. That's kind of a weird place to stop because we haven't actually said what God's going to say, but there's a lot going on in those four verses.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I actually had marked verses 2 to 3 that my translation, once again, is slightly different than yours, but I want to read them because I think they're just exquisite. Thus said the Lord who is planning it, the Lord who is shaping it to bring it about, whose name is Lord. Call to me and I will answer you, and I will tell you wondrous things, secrets you have not known. I just feel so much hopelessness in hope. Sorry, I feel so much hopefulness in the idea of a Lord who is planning it. We don't know planning what, and we don't know what are the wondrous secrets, but I don't know. It immediately tells you there's a future. Even though it might not feel like there's a future right now.
Oh, I see. The NRSV there is reading the Greek.
Interesting.
But I really like the translation that you're reading, which is a little more elusive about exactly like this thing that is about to happen, God is planning. And, and that's kind of the wonderful
thing. And that's the wondrous thing. And it's a secret that you haven't known. And
yeah.
Yeah, really, it sort of draws me in.
In verse 4, we get... Thus says the Lord, concerning the houses of this city and the houses of the kings of Judah that were torn down to make a defense against the siege ramps and before the sword.
Mm-hmm. Is that like some kind of military defense?
That's what it sounds like to me. So, the Babylonians have brought this siege apparatus to the city. And so it sounds to me like the inhabitants of Jerusalem are tearing down all the things, even the houses of the kings, in order to build... Like fortify
a wall.
Just to make more rubble for people to have to like pick their way through. Yeah.
And it's such a sort of tragic image, like the most beautiful structures that they have created, the palaces of the kings and the houses of the city. They're destroying their own houses to create rubble to try to save their lives, to try to save Babylonians from being able to come in.
It's right.
Pretty depressing.
And so the direness of that situation of we're just like we're down to the lat, like we've run out of ideas and we're just like piling stuff against the door kind of.
Right.
And then juxtaposed with what you just read about I'm making plans for you, great and wonderful things that you have not known. And like those two things stand so sharply.
So far apart. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so then we get God's pronouncement. So thus says the Lord, the Chaldeans are coming in to fight and to fill them with the dead bodies of those whom I shall strike down in my anger and my wrath, for I have hidden my face from this city because of all their wickedness.
There is a section at the beginning of verse 5 that looks like the Hebrew is pretty difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
My translation has, and were filled by those who went to fight the Chaldeans with the corpses of the men whom I struck down in my anger and my rage. So it sounds like they're also using dead bodies to fortify their space.
Yeah, so they've just, so they've taken, I mean, almost like you put up sandbags or something to protect against floodwaters.
I mean, it's just the worst of the worst. Everything that could be representative of human dignity is being thrown at this problem.
So in the NRSV, it's the Chaldeans who are coming in to produce dead bodies, right? They're getting ready to breach the wall and kill a bunch of people that are going to fill in these spaces.
Yeah.
But either way you read it, right, it's hopelessness and despair. Mm-hmm. And that second half of that verse, I have hidden my face from this city because of all their wickedness. Mm-hmm. So do you have thoughts about that, sort of the hidden face of God?
I mean, this is a theme or a sort of theological direction that comes up a lot in post-Holocaust theology, just sort of the idea that it's not that God doesn't exist and it's not that God directly brings about the bad thing that happened, but God sort of averts God's eyes while it happens because of the wickedness. And so it's sort of this middle place between saying God caused the destruction and trying to grapple with the idea that God couldn't have prevented it.
Now, in the middle of this kind of, like, this is pretty stark so far, right?
Yeah, it's awful.
And then in the middle of that, God begins in verse 6, I am going to bring it recovery and healing. I will heal them and reveal to them abundance of prosperity and security. I will restore the fortunes of Judah and the fortunes of Israel and rebuild them as they were at first. I will cleanse them from all the guilt of their sin against me, and I will forgive all the guilt of their sin and rebellion against me. And this city shall be to me a name of joy, a praise and a glory before all the nations of the earth, who shall hear of all the good things that I do for them. They shall fear and tremble because of all the good and all the prosperity I provide for it. One of the things that really strikes me is that last couple of lines, that the nations are looking and they're trembling. But here it's not God's like punishment that's making nations tremble. It's the like God is able to do this restoration and to restore Jerusalem. And so the nations are so in awe of God's healing power that they begin to shake and to tremble. Such an interesting thing to think about that being the message in this context that we were talking about with the siege that is taking place.
You know, in some ways it fits with this utter like debasement, you know, that they've been describing in the onslaught of violence and sort of the just general sense of like human dignity that is lost in this whole process, that then it swings the pendulum completely to the other side and says, you will have so much dignity and honor and comfort that everyone will look at you and say, wow.
Picking up in verse 10, thus says the Lord, in this place of which you say it is a waste without human beings or animals, in the towns of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem that are desolate without inhabitants, human or animal, there shall once more be heard the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the voices of those who sing as they bring thank offerings to the house of the Lord. Give thanks to the Lord of hosts, for the Lord is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. For I will restore the fortunes of the land as at first, says the Lord.
Bobby.
Yes.
Have you ever written a strategic plan?
I have. I've been asked to do it anyway. I'm not sure how strategic I really was about it.
No. Okay, this is like, I'm going to bring this to my board as an example of a vision statement. This is the vision. Like, do you not want to climb into this world where like think of where they are.
Yeah.
And now they're talking about like a voice of mirth and gladness. They're like piling up dead bodies like sandbags.
Yeah.
There's going to be a bridegroom and a bride and people are going to be singing like Hodul Adonai. Like, come on. But it paints it so like I can see it. I can like taste it. I can.
Yeah.
This is a good vision statement. A+, Jeremiah.
It's really nice. And that the image there of being the bride and the bridegroom, there's so much in there about personal joy, but also about building of family units and also about fertility and fecundity.
Yeah.
And in this place that is surrounded by death, this idea of new lives beginning it's a really inviting image on kind of the personal level that people can relate to. And then there's also the worship center, right? The people are going to be coming to the temple again and bringing their offerings and singing thanks to God.
Yeah. It's unimaginable, almost unimaginable, you know, based on sort of what's actually going on around Jeremiah at this time.
Yes. So Jeremiah is holding out that kind of that image of, even though this seems like it is not possible right now, the Lord is saying, and these are the wonderful things, right? That you can't,
these are the
wondrous can't understand.
Things that you have
How
not
would
known.
You ever get there? I don't know, but this is the promise that's there. The prophecy continues in verse 12. Thus says the Lord of hosts, in this place that is a waste without human beings or animals, and in all its towns, there shall again be pasture for shepherds resting their flocks. In the towns of the hill country of the Shephelah and of the Negev, in the land of Benjamin, the places around Jerusalem, and in the towns of Judah, flocks shall again pass under the hands of the one who counts them, says the Lord.
Like, just this image of sheep passing under the hand of those who counts them. Like, that detail is so moving to me.
Yeah. Can you say a little more about that?
Well, just that it's, I mean, it's just sort of a fact of life, I would guess, when you are a shepherd, you know, you need to be able to count your flock, but how low on your list of things to do counting your sheep would be if you were, you know, really in this kind of crisis. And so to envision a time where things are so back to normal that this sort of mundane but peaceful and practical and lovely practice of just counting your sheep. And the idea that the sheep, you know, once again have a human caretaker who is looking after them and minding them and knows that they exist and knows where they are and knows, you know, their hobbies.
That's really lovely. Because that previous sort of oracle was about kind of the, you know, it was about the bride and the bridegroom, which is this sort of once in a lifetime kind of, like, it's a singular event.
Right, it's a sing. Yes, you're right. Mm-hmm.
Whereas the count, I like the way you said that, like, the counting of the sheep is a mundane daily kind of thing. And so not only these kind of glorious moments, but also the boring stuff of everyday life, like, that's coming back too.
Right.
And now we can appreciate it in a different way.
Those are the things you crave when you're in crisis, you know, like, you just want to do that mundane thing, you know, that you never maybe paid much attention to before.
So that brings us to the part of this text that is actually
that is the narrative lectionary text. Yes, yeah, that was all an introduction.
I really think in order to make sense of this, I mean, and the reason we made this decision to start, but in order to make sense of this, you need to have thought of all of that, right? This little thing just pulled out. I don't know. It just makes more sense when you think about it in the context of the rest of the passage.
Mm-hmm.
The days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will fulfill the promise I made to the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. In those days and at that time, I will cause a righteous branch to spring up for David, and he shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. In those days, Judah will be saved, Jerusalem will live in safety, and this is the name by which it will be called, the Lord is our righteousness. For thus says the Lord, David shall never lack a man to sit on the throne of the house of Israel, and the Levitical priests shall never lack a man in my presence to offer burnt offerings, to make grain offerings, and to make sacrifices for all time. So now we've moved, I think, into the realm. So we've talked about family life, marriage, and maybe in children. We've talked about shepherding. Now we're talking about the monarchy, the king, and we're talking about the religious authorities, the priests of the temple, as part of this vision of restoration. What do you make of these images of the righteous branch and the Levitical priests returning?
This, to me, is sort of getting to the relationship between the people and God, of which the king is sort of a part of that, the way that this theology is set up. You know, the king is chosen by God to help rule the people, and the king is also accountable to God. So I guess I see this text sort of moving into that, you know, making that relationship the way it is meant to be, and, like, restoring the systems that broke down that are supposed to be supporting that relationship.
You know, when I look at it, I see what you're saying about the restoration of the structures, right? So here we have the governmental structure being put in place, and then we have the religious structure being put in place. And these are the two main structures that oriented life, the life of Israel and Judah in the pre-exilic period. And these are also the two things that got the Israelites and the Judahites in trouble in the first place, is their, especially their kings, and also their priests and their prophets, didn't seek the will of God. And so this is, I mean, in the sort of most mundane sense, this is a reconstructing of functional systems of government and religion. And I do think that God is also there, but I'm actually not seeing this as like the primary point is that this is a restoration of the relationship. To me, this is more the fulfillment of God's promise to Israel than it is the restoration of Israel's devotion to God. Although maybe those two things aren't really separable.
When this text refers to, I will fulfill the promise I made to the house of Israel and the house of Judah, what promise do you think that is?
Yeah, when I read that, I'm thinking about the promise to David in 2 Samuel 7 mm-hmm. that there will always be a Davidic mm-hmm. heir on the throne in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. What do you think when you read that?
I think it could be that. I think it could be, it refers to the house of Israel, the house of Judah, which makes it sort of more likely to be in that time period. I mean, there are other sort of covenants that God makes with the people of Israel earlier, like back in Genesis.
Yeah, but in verse 15 where it says, I will cause a righteous branch to spring up for David.
Yeah.
Doesn't that kind of narrow it down? Or are you thinking that as a different idea?
I don't think that those have to refer to the same thing. Like, I think it could be, I will fulfill the promise that I made. And at that time, I will also raise up a true branch of David's line.
So then the promise that is in verse 14
would be a broader promise. I guess I'm a little surprised after all of this, like, description of, like, the horror that they're in and then all these incredible visions, that it really comes down to the Davidic line. Like, is that really the promise? Because that promise was fulfilled for a long time and there were a line of crappy kings. So you're going to put another king in there, but this time is going to be good, I promise? Or is there a broader promise of which this king fits into?
I think it is a broader promise in the sense that what God has in mind is the thriving mm-hmm. of Israel and Judah.
Yes.
And I think that the way God has in mind in this passage that that's going to take place is under the leadership of a Davidic king and a Levitical priest. So you get in verse 17, David shall never lack a man to sit on the throne. That's 2 Samuel 7. Mm-hmm. And the Levitical priest shall never lack a man in the presence, in my presence to offer burnt offerings, which isn't in 2 Samuel 7. So here we have the monarchy and the temple cult mm-hmm. together. And when those two things are functioning correctly, then there will be the thriving of Israel and Judah. That's how I'm putting all of that together, because I don't know how to make sense of the repeated like reference to David and the Davidic king on the throne and all of those things, unless that's what this thing is envisioning.
Is it like everything's going to be so great, and when all that happens, there's going to be this king, which is going to be this also great thing? Or does the king need to be in place in order for those other things to happen?
The way that I read it, and I recognize this is probably only one way that one could read it, is that the king and the priest are the precondition for all of these other things happening. Or at least they're the co-condition that in order for this kind of stable world in which songs are sung and marriages are taking place and mm-hmm. which sheep are roaming in the field, requires the leadership of the king, who is here envisioned as a Davidic king, and the priest, who is here envisioned as a Levitical priest. And those things all together are what make up this idyllic world that Jeremiah is anticipating.
I mean, I certainly see how that could be. I'm not saying that's an invalid reading. It just seems to me like it set this whole scene, like all this stuff will happen, and also there will be, like, it seems like a messianic era to me, of which the king is a part, but the king doesn't necessarily bring about the other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, so I feel like the at essence, what the discussion that we're having at this moment is about the importance of the promise of a Davidic king, which, mm-hmm. as you have mentioned, is related to messianic promise. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it is certainly the case that I am a Christian biblical scholar who is thinking about the fact that this text is being read in our tradition on the first Sunday of Advent, which is the beginning of the 4 weeks anticipating the birth of Jesus at Christmas. And so this text in our liturgical calendar falls on the day that we start waiting, basically. Advent is a time of Christian time of waiting for the arrival of the Messiah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I have a vested theological interest in mm-hmm. thinking that the Davidic promise that's here is important to the text.
But you are right to underscore that, like, this is a point in the text that is important, that is particularly important to Christian theology.
Yeah.
And so, it would make sense, I guess, that we would pause on it.
So I interpret your reading with the opposite resistance, which is mm-hmm. That you don't want to see a messianic promise here. And so whereas the text seems to me to be fairly clearly a prediction of a restoration of the Davidic monarchy, you don't really want to read it that way. And so I think there's a theological investment there as well.
Yes, I agree there's a theological investment, but it's not that I don't see a restoration of the Davidic monarchy. It's that I don't think that the restoration of the Davidic monarchy is like the overarching thing for the entire vision. I think it's one aspect of this vision.
So it's really interesting, however you put it together, that we're in a situation. So if we go back to where Jeremiah is, like the Babylonians have not yet even breached the wall of Jerusalem. The mm-hmm. exile, properly speaking, hasn't even begun yet.
Mm-hmm.
There was a deportation 10 years ago in 597 of some of the elites of Jerusalem mm-hmm. into Babylon. But the kind of the destruction of the city, the destruction of the temple, the exile, properly speaking, is still a year away. And yet here we have Jeremiah predicting or offering at least a vision of a restored Judah and Jerusalem and Israel even before the destruction has yet finished happening.
Right.
This kind of language is more comfortable in a place like the second part of Isaiah or somewhere like that, which is at the end of the exile and is anticipating restoration. But it's really interesting to me to anticipate restoration when you haven't even hit bottom yet.
Yeah. You are still going down.
That's exactly right. So even while you are still headed toward rock bottom, mm-hmm. and here we are, stacking up rubble, stacking up bodies. There's an army around the city, and he's able to talk about a time when everything is going to be the way that it should be.
Yeah. I love this chapter. I love the way that it holds so much dark and so much light sort of at the same time. And I love what you just underscored about the fact that we know as readers, they haven't hit bottom yet. Like, this is going to get worse before it gets better, which feels almost more excruciating to me now that this hope has been articulated.
Yeah.
Maybe just because of the contrast.
Yeah. And you said we as readers know, but which is true, but also Jeremiah seems to know.
Yeah.
Because he's been saying throughout his book, the Babylonians are coming and it's going to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jeremiah is not naively prophesying a restoration that's going to be an easy shortcut to this thing that seems to be difficult.
Right.
He's actually, I think, understands that the Babylonians are going to come in and there's going to be a lot more destruction and a lot more pain and an extended period of being away from mm-hmm. home. And then there's going to be a restoration. So he's not shortcutting the situation that they're in.
I think the other thing that feels feels real to me in various ways in our own lives and our own history right now, but is that, you know, this is a long-term bad situation that they're in. And so while in the sweep of the history of Israel, things, you know, there is this hope that things will get better, it's not hopeful for the individual per se. It's hopeful for the community or the system or the, you know.
Yeah. So maybe you might want to build on that. I don't know, but when you think you started sort of moving there toward, so what is the takeaway for us and for our communities? Do you have thoughts about what the meaning or importance of that is in your own place?
In a lot of ways, for me, as sort of a member of a religious community and also, you know, a citizen of this country and of the world and a parent to my children, I do in very real ways mourn when I see things happening in the world or in the community that I don't believe are going to be fixed in my lifetime and I think are actually going to get worse in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. But it does make a difference to know or to have a vision, I guess, that it's not a downward trajectory forever. Like there can be grief in that downward trajectory for me as an individual and just for like a human being who's suffering, at the same time that it's a different kind of hope. Like, it's not this like gleeful hope. Yeah. You know, I liked when you were talking about Advent as like it's a period of waiting.
Yeah.
And it is waiting, but it's also a recognition that you may die waiting. But the waiting is real. You're not waiting for nothing. It's just you might not get to see it play out.
I really like the way you were talking about Advent there in terms of, like, one of the things that really frustrates me about what Christmas has become in the U.S. in particular is, like, I mean, we started, like, celebrating Christmas, like, 2 weeks ago already. Like,
we've already gone to see a Christmas movie. And we're Jews.
That's my favorite thing ever. Yeah, I mean, like, Christmas has been happening, like Starbucks decorated for Christmas in, like, it wasn't even mid-November, I think, when my Starbucks decorated for Christmas. And so, like, we don't have patience for the waiting. Mm-hmm. It's like we want to get to the thing, which is the kind of shortcut that we were talking about earlier that mm-hmm. Jeremiah is very insistently refusing. Mm-hmm. We live in a world, I mean, it's not as dire for many of us anyway as the world that Jeremiah is writing from, but it's pretty dire, and it depends a lot on where you are situated. Mm-hmm. And so to shortcut the direness in order to celebrate the restoration is troubling both for this Jeremiah text and also, I think, for what Advent is supposed to mean for those of us who are in the Christian faith, which is to say Advent is a period in which we acknowledge that there is gloom and darkness, and yet there is a light which hasn't been extinguished. Mm-hmm. Instead of just saying, like, the world is all lightness and joy,
right.
The image is there is a light that has not been overcome. And so I don't quite know how you inhabit that place. Like, if you try to preach that every week, like, hey, the world is really, really terrible, but it's not only terrible, like, your congregation might well shrink, you know?
Yeah.
But I think there is something to that, both communally and also personally, about not shortcutting the difficult things to get to the hopefulness, mm-hmm. but also not forgetting that there's hopefulness in the midst of the difficult things.
Yeah. No, that's really beautiful. And I think, you know, that's part of why I think when you and I read the narrative lectionary on our own this week, we really felt strongly like we had to contextualize it a little bit within this chapter and a little bit historically, because if you don't understand the darkness of the times that they're in and then understand the huge leap to the sense of hope in the vision sort of as it unfolds through the chapter, it does a disservice to the narrative lectionary itself, because you don't sort of understand where you're coming from.
And I really appreciate what you were saying about the narrative lectionary. And like, if you just pulled out verses 14 to 18, like, this is kind of, I mean, it's just like, it's almost a little, dare I say, almost a little trite to pull out 14 to 18 and just say, hey, there's going to be a righteous branch.
Right.
Without saying the profound incongruity of that claim, mm-hmm. given what's going on. Mm-hmm. So I really hope people who might be preaching this text will think about either giving some background or reading some more of the text.
Yeah.
So Amy, I really appreciate this conversation, and this has been a hard one for me, I'm not going to lie. And I'm kind of glad I'm not preaching this one, because I don't know for sure what
good luck,
saying.
People!
But anyway, I think there's a lot of richness here. It's just not an easy richness. It's a profoundly difficult richness, I think.
I mean, I think that's what we were saying. You can just go for the candy at the end and say, like, woohoo, there's going to be a new king. Or you can go for the richness and you're going to have to work for it.
Yes. So next week, the narrative lectionary is leading us into the second part of Isaiah, chapter 40, verses 1 through 11. Second Isaiah is one of the texts written at the end of the exile, and so it's proclaiming kind of the hope of a restoration there mm-hmm. as well, in kind of a different way than Jeremiah has done. All right, Amy, good to talk to you all. Talk to you next week.
You too. Have a good one. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for People on the Go. We'll be back next week when the Narrative Lectionary leads us into Isaiah 40, the comforting words of the prophet known as 2nd Isaiah. We'll see you then.